Take it away. Unmute and take it away.
All right. Good morning, everybody. It's great to see you all. A lot of familiar faces. And it's just another, I don't do a ton of Zoom meetings. My name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic. And as Jim mentioned, I am currently serving as the Area 50 Panel 74 delegate. So I've just gotten into my ninth month of this. And it's been a terrific experience, which I will obviously falls into my story a little bit. So I'll spend a little bit more time on it. But we just finished our area assembly where we worked on our calendar and the budget. And like so many things in Alcoholics Anonymous, these revelations we get as we get more in tune with following this loving power that's by far greater than us and helps us with everything is I never looked at a calendar in my entire life. So I am eternally grateful to Jim. And he's like, I don't want to seem like I'm bothering you, but it wasn't a bother at all, because what I did learn and what I've been seeing and what I wanted from other people in AA is they never said no. I think my most lasting impression of AA, which I couldn't understand when I first came in, was that people extended their hand to me and expected nothing in return. And I couldn't get my arms around that, because I always came from the perspective that if I've done something for you, whether you were aware of it or not, and most oftentimes you weren't, that you owed me. And you build on this, and then the world owes you more and more and more, and you don't understand what I've done. You don't understand what I am and this whole thing. So I'll give you a little bit more background on how I got here. So I came in, my sobriety date is March 22nd, 2008 at 12:07 a.m. And I came in when I was 44. So I just turned 60. And I was ready. Could I have come in the rooms earlier? Absolutely. But I wasn't ready. And I had to go through a lot of really burning down the house. And for a long time, I thought my drinking was exceptional. And I thought my lifestyle was exceptional. And what I looked at when I find my about my drinking is it wasn't the only thing about my drinking that was exceptional is that I was exceptionally drunk a lot. And I wasn't a daily drinker. I was a binge drinker, but my binges would last for days. And then I would think I was recovering, but I really wasn't, because unbeknownst to me, this thing was running me around the whole time. And so I would stop for a little while, get my act together, do everything, and kind of feel that way about it. And then that obsession would come back that, you know, maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe I could do this thing again. And I would do it again. And I'd do it again. And I would do it again. And the consequences kept getting greater and greater and greater. And I kept doing it. And I couldn't see it. So what I was just, you know, it's so fortunately, and I think a lot of us, at least I hope this is my experience, and I should give you the AA caveat, which I think is important. Whatever I share is my experience. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I speak for my experience within Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even speak for my home group. I speak for my experience within my home group. But I am a member of both, and I respect it and understand it. And for a long time, I didn't understand our structure. And I have great sponsorship, and I've had great sponsorship from the beginning. And that is important. And it's been a big thing. And I work with a lot of different men at a lot of different levels of sobriety. Some a lot of newcomers, a lot of people that have lengthier times of sobriety than me. It just sort of works. And I'm a big believer that with this fellowship, and as I learn more about it in the service structure, our unity, and then our responsibility statement. And that's been on my mind a lot lately. This, I am responsible when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. And I thought, well, God, that's a huge, huge ask. How do I do that? And I was really missing the biggest part of that statement is it's the hand of AA has to be there. And I'm just not even a finger in the hand. I'm maybe one pit of cell. So if I'm involved in it, I'm involved in my home group and I'm involved in my area and I'm involved in my district and all these things, it really helps. And, you know, I came in 2008, that wasn't on the radar screen. I wanted to quit drinking. And I had blown up my life on a pretty epic proportion, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I'll give you the background on it. Things came easy for me. I never really had to work that hard at anything. And that's a little bit of a blessing and a lot of a curse, because you don't know the value of anything when it comes easy to you. I mean, friends came easy, girls came easy, work came easy. I just didn't think it was hard, and I loved to drink. And drugs are a part of my story, but I believe strongly in our singleness of purpose. And so, but drug, you know, alcohol was there at the beginning. It was there at the end. Drugs would come and go, but that was the main staple through it. So I really do identify as an alcoholic, although I do attend some NA meetings with sponsees that are whatever to find the right group for them. And then again, that goes into what does the hand of AA do? So the hand of AA is there, expects nothing in return, only that we put a little bit of effort towards helping the next person who's sick and suffering, alcoholic, who wants to seek help. That's the job. So it's been a great experience with it. So in 2008, when I came in, there was nothing left. I had gotten divorced in 2000. Beautiful wife, three kids. Divorce was imminent. It was definitely me. I was the only person remotely involved or aware of this marriage that thought it was going to continue. So I was genuinely surprised and hurt and resentful when she cut me loose. And I did what any good alcoholic would do. I went on a tear. So I worked harder. I made more money. I didn't pay my taxes. I dated anyone and anything I could date. I wouldn't even learn their names. I dated the school teacher, the nurse, many nurses, the doctor, the lawyer, the riding instructor, the florist, the dry cleaner. It didn't matter. I didn't know any of their, really get into a relationship with them. And I'll come back to that later, and I would just move on to the next. And that worked for about 2.5 years. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I met my current wife in 2003. And we dated for a while, and then I lost everything and we got married because I needed a place to live. Now, I have shared this with her, and she saw something in me that I couldn't see. And that's been sort of, as I reflect back on how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and what Alcoholics Anonymous has done to me. And I hope this is an experience that all of you guys have shared in some way, shape, or form, is that throughout our lives, there has always been people there trying to help us. This hand of the world, there's always been somebody there that we just couldn't see it. It just wasn't in our radar. And we don't understand that we can't see it, or I couldn't, until the fact that I realized that this disease has me completely selfish and self-centered, even though my view of myself is that I'm a turd. You know, I'm not worthy of this stuff. So why are you doing it? And I have this facade. And Bill has great analogies throughout our literature of, you know, I'm the actor playing these different parts. I'm these different people. And if I run the show, it's great. And when the show doesn't go off well, then it doesn't go so well. And so it's been a good thing. And I work with a guy, a Jesuit priest out in California, who helps me with some different stuff. And he talks about this lizard brain. And it's a big analogy for him. And he said, you know, Steve, we're like lizards. You know, if we have sunlight and flies, we're happy. You take away the sunlight and the flies, and we are unhappy. And that sort of thing, it's really that simple. And I know that's an oversimplification of sorts, but that's how I had behavior. As long as I got what I wanted and I would do anything to get that, I was fine. But I wasn't fine. I was still always restless, irritable, and discontented. And I found a level of contentment and comfort. And I've had this throughout. Like, as Jim mentioned, his father and my mother were brother and sister. And my parents have passed, as his dad has, and we have this beach house up in Canada. And I recall going back as I was thinking about this morning when I was riding my bike, what I was going to talk about, of my Uncle Jim sitting on the beach on an odd day during high school when he would leave his office as an attorney in Buffalo, and he would just bring a book and he would sit on the beach and read his book. And it was just doing what he did, getting his work done, being a good provider, good brother to his sister, spending some time with her, but he liked his time alone in that side. And I just couldn't understand that. How could you be so peaceful sitting on a beach reading by yourself, in the middle of the day during the week? And this is when this is during the summer when we're in high school on summer break, and we're off drinking in the woods or drinking on the beach, whatever we, depending on the age it was. And he was just there, never bothered by anybody. And he just was a really was a bright, grateful guy. And that same thing with my mother. She was the same thing. So I had great parents, I had great family all around it. I have two brothers and two sisters, and then I have a cousin who's extremely close to us, really part of our family from my father's side. And so we have this big tribe, and I'm the only one. I'm the only one, and I used to kind of think, why me? But that's the way it is. I have accepted the fact. The answer to a lot of my questions is that I'm an alcoholic. And when I can accept that and surrender to the fact that I am powerless over these things and find a power greater than myself, and that has really been my goal, is to constantly have more spiritual growth with this. And it's a tough task for me. So I get divorced. I move in with Lori. We get remarried. We get married, her first marriage. And then she starts to unravel all the mess. And the mess was severe. I owed the IRS a huge sum of money. I owed New York State a huge sum of money. I was that guy taking the notices from the tax returns and whatnot and putting them in my sock drawer, hiding them because they would go away. I would get there before the mail would come. I would do all these things. This is it. This is the age of 45. I'm not in high school or grammar school stealing my report card. I'm doing this as a 45-year-old seventh grader. And I have to look at that and I have to own that. And that was my behavior. And that behavior had to change. And so she's a very fiscally responsible person. And she worked with it. And when all this came to light, which it took a few years. We got married in 2005, and I would not come into the rooms until 2008. And from 2006 until 2008, I worked for six, I believe, different companies. I had become unemployable. I had worked for a company here in Buffalo for a long time in the international division. Became a managing director for the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and Africa, traveled all over the world, been in different jails for drunken behavior in Egypt and Mexico, all over. Had to take solace at the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait twice because, I don't know if you're aware of that, but some Muslim countries forbid alcohol. And that's a bad thing if you're a foreign national with found that in their country. So just crazy stuff that I would do and everywhere and just all around. So the behaviors were always there. There was, and it could be got worse and worse and worse. And so then I worked for a medical device company for 6 years, and then I lost that job too. In both these instances, both those companies did not want to fire me, but they had to. They had to. They had no choice. And that's so I have relationships with both those previous employers and have been able to make the amends to them both. And then from that point on, I just would work for wherever I could get a paycheck. And by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had stolen a paycheck for so long that I just didn't think I was worthy at all. And the only thing that seemed to work was it. So what does any good alcoholic do when they can't get gainful employment? They become a bartender. So I started working at the Town Ballroom in 2006, which is a music hall downtown. And the two owners of that place were great because I'm a great bartender. And a lot of fun, and people like it, and I can make them some money, and that was it. And I would do that, and I would continue to work for at the Town Ballroom up until 2022. So I worked as a bartender in sobriety, much to the chagrin of my sponsor, who would say, you know, if you go to the to a barbershop, Steve, you're gonna get a haircut. And so maybe out of like to prove them wrong, whatever, but it was a thing I needed to do. And I felt a responsibility. And these guys saw me at the peak of my alcoholism. It stuck with me when I got sober, as did the last thing. So the straw that broke the camel's back was I was working for a company here in Buffalo, a big bank, and I was working in their insurance division. And I was had become their number one insurance producer in this bank. Now it's a, you know, it's a huge bank, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of thing. Insurance was a tiny asset of it and a tiny division of it. So the numbers weren't even relevant, but I was the number one sales guy. And then one day I get called down to New York City to headquarters, and I'm in the legal department office with the head of the insurance group. And they're sitting me down, and this looks bad. This looks bad for me. And so I'm sitting there with them, and they say, do you realize, Steve, that every day you have come to work for this institution, you have committed a felony? And I'm like, I don't understand what you're talking about. He said, you don't have an insurance license. And that was true. I did not have an insurance license. And my rebuttal to them, and this is true alcoholic reasoning, is you never asked for one. And they said, well, you know, we're going to have to, we're going to pursue charges with you. And again, as a true alcoholic, I'm like, well, I don't think you are. And the corporate counsel for the institution said, why is that, Steve? Why do you think we're not going to pursue? I'm like, because I didn't write anything on my insurance license. I wrote it all on yours. And he was, couldn't really argue with that. And he said, well, then we're going to just part ways. So I didn't get handcuffed walking out of there, but I was able to be escorted out of the building and then permanently unemployed from that industry and that side to it. However, the guy that I worked for during that time was a sober guy. And a couple years later, after I finished it up and was just tending bar, and that got worse and worse and worse, and I missed my sister-in-law's 50th birthday party because I was at the Town Ballroom, and this was on March 21st of 2008. I was working at the Town Ballroom. I went to go, got there at 6 o'clock for a 6 o'clock show. The show wasn't until 9. I started drinking. After a couple hours of drinking, I borrowed $100 off the porter who didn't have $100 to give me. I left because I still had an hour to go work. I went down to the Lafayette Tap Room. I ran into a friend with a big bag of blow. The next thing I know, it's 11 o'clock. I'm on the dance floor with a woman who's not my wife. I'm pouring a drink in my mouth. I can remember this vividly. And I'm looking at myself as I'm pouring it down going, what am I doing? And that was my moment. I called my wife. She could tell I was out of it. And her words will ring to me true forever. She said, Steve, if you want to live your life this way, live your life this way. I will not live my life this way. Do not bother coming home. So I don't have a home. The $100 is gone. I don't have any money. What do? I break into my parents' house. They were away on vacation, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and I'm looking at the microwave oven. As I sit at the kitchen table, I have a beer in front of me, and I look at the clock, and it says 12:07 a.m. and I push the beer away and I think I go to bed. I didn't go to bed. I went into the family room. I fell asleep on the, I must have called my brother before, because when I woke up in the morning, he was lying there. He was sitting in the chair with his fiance and they were looking at me, and I looked up from the floor and I said, "I need help." He goes, "You do. I can't help you, but I know somebody who can." And he I called Eddie M, and I talked to Eddie M for incessantly. I talked, "Eddie, I got to do this. Eddie, I got to do this. I got to do this. I got to fix this. I got to do this. I got to get to this. I got to do this. I got to do this." And Eddie listened. He didn't say a word, really. He would interject here and there, but he didn't say much. Then Eddie finally came back and he said, "Steve, you know, I've been listening to you for a while. All this time, I'm pretty sure I haven't heard you take a breath. What you need to do is breathe. And if you want to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, pick me up at 5:30, and we'll go over to Madonna Hall at Juval, and you can go to your first meeting." Now, I thought that was my first meeting, but my cousin Jim will tell you the truth. That was not my first meeting, because my ex-wife back in 2000 said, "Go to a meeting." And so I went to a meeting and I saw Jim and I saw all you happy losers sitting there, and I did not want to be at that meeting, and I hated it, and I stonewalled it, and I sat there. Somebody gave me a big book. I threw it in the trunk of the car. I never cracked the spine of it, and sold it later at a garage sale. Whatever, that's a different story for another time. And didn't think I would darken the doors of AA again, but the seed was planted. It just took 8 years to germinate because I needed to keep watering it, I suppose. And that's you know, that's sort of the exposure to it. So as I work and work with newer people, my expectations of them getting this is always tempered, because I think it came easy for me, but it didn't. It took a long time. It takes a long time, and it takes a lot of diligence and work to get to that. So I get in, I get Eddie, I keep going with it. And Eddie's like, this is, you know, we meet Sunday, we talk all day Sunday. My wife actually picks up the phone for me and says, okay, she's still not ready to get back in the house, but my parents were gone, so I could still stay there. And then Monday comes along and he says, "Meet me at University Men's. It's 8:30 on Monday." So I get there about 8:15 and I'm sitting in the parking lot. Now remember, I'm 44 years old. I'm petrified to walk in the door by myself. I need this security blanket of Eddie M to take me in the building. And Eddie texting him like crazy, maybe 30 times in that 15-minute span. And he finally replies back at like 8:25. He says, "I'm not going to make it. Just go in." And I went inside, and I run into some people I know. They grab me a chair. I sit down. They grab two new guys. Well, I think they have a lot of experience. One had 10 months, the other one 11 months. And they sat him right down next to me. And the guy said, "You're going to stay close to this guy." And I have remained as close to those two men as I've remained to anybody, even though I don't see them every week or every month, even. But when I do see them, there's a connection there that I can't describe. Like, because we went through this together, even though I'm a little bit behind them in sobriety time, we did everything together for the next 18 months. Everything. We went to every meeting together. We went to breakfast together. We went to all these things together. And I'm like, "Look, I don't have any money for breakfast." And I remember the one guy turned to me and he said, "Steve, look, nobody's ever starved to death in AA. You come to breakfast with us. Don't worry about that." And that's been my case. So the more we break bread, the more we're together, this fellowship, this unity, this connection, this really reaching out to another person resonates with me more and more. And it's really the magic of the whole thing. So those guys are great. I get into it. I start working, going to meetings with them. I go to Cayuga Men's. I don't have a car. My wife has a car. So I often ride my wife's scooter to different meetings. Whatever I had to do, I got a job working for a guy power washing toys and brick buildings and stuff. And, you know, A's, we're good workers because we're a little obsessive. I don't know if you know that, but we can really get after it. And these guys would just be like, wow, this guy won't finish till the job's done. And so it was great. So I worked for him for a while, and then my sponsor finally said, you know, it might be time for you to go back to work. One of the guys I had worked for at that financial institution was a sober guy, and he said, yeah, you know, I call him, I said, yeah, I've been sober now for X amount of days. He said, well, I'll hire you again, but you have to get licensed. You have to have your insurance license. I did that, and I got my test, and they had started a company, and I worked for them for about a year. And then got pretty good at it, and then got an offer from a different company, which he was all for, and started becoming a general agent for a different insurance company in 2009, and that has been my recovery job since then. So it sort of worked. So that massive debt to the IRS was paid off by, I take the sobriety date, by 2013, through offering compromise with the IRS, with offering compromise with New York State, through the help of non-alcoholics, people who are experts in this thing that understand. And that's really my experience. There's a lot of people out there that want to help. They just want a genuine effort and an honest look that people will help you. And I think that was taught to me of my parents, and I didn't realize this. And it's been a big thing. My parents were really big on two things, and they really felt that two things were really in it. Every human being on the planet wanted to do two things with their abilities, and that is they wanted to teach people what they know, and people want to help. And being able to ask for help and being able to willing to accept help and being able to know what help to do it is a big thing. But deep at everyone's core, now there's sociopaths out there for sure, who don't want to, but there are others that will help you. It will really help you do whatever you need to do, because there's things we can't handle, but we think we can handle everything. And so going through the steps and learning all that, and so that has been my experience. So I'm actually just finished. I'm a squash pro. I'm like a Jamaican. I have about four jobs, although I've whittled it down. I only have three now. So I coach squash for Canisius High School, which is a really proud thing to do. And then I am the squash pro at the Saturn Club, where Sunday mornings are our clinic, but I have great assistants. But I just gave a lesson at 8:30 this morning to the granddaughter of the forensic accountant who helped me settle and provide my offer and compromise to the IRS. How's that work? Right? How's that possible? So those connections that we make and these things, and now in some way, shape, or form, I can get back to her and I can help her do some things. And she's a terrific young girl. So it's just kind of cool. And he dropped her off, which is even better. So I hadn't seen him since 2013 or 15, 13, 14. So stuff like that keeps happening all the time. And I used to think, wow, what a coincidence. I don't think it is a coincidence at all. I think if we continue to do what's best and what's right, we're going to get what we get, but we know that we can learn from it and keep moving on. And that's kind of right sizing, and that's kind of just working in the focus with it. So I get back to work. I've got a nice business going. We have good years, we have bad years, but this coaching aspect to me has been a great gift that continues to give, and I think it translates that into AA. And we see a lot of this. And this is really what I want to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know it when I got into it. You know, Chuck was the delegate in panel 68. And he's like, you should come to an area assembly. I didn't know what an area assembly was. I had been a GSR for set aside group when we were at the temple. And I had gone to some district meetings, and it seemed very confusing and very unorganized, and nobody really knew what to do and how it was going to work. And to a newcomer, it wasn't very attractive. And I think that's something that we have to always focus on. Like, our primary purpose and what we do here is, why was AA attractive to me? Well, people that were in it, they had something I wanted. It looked attractive when I was ready for it. 2000, I wasn't ready for it. It didn't look attractive. And I remember this, the look on my cousin Jim's face when I walked into that meeting. He lit up like a Christmas tree, and I'm like, "What? Where am I? What am I doing here?" It was the last thing, and I guarantee you, later that day, I was out drinking and drugging. I'm sure. So now we make, how do we make AA attractive? How do we do it? Well, that's our responsibility. That's each individual members of AA's responsibility. That am I a good home group member? Am I a good thing? And I look at back at my career and I can say, probably not. I could be better, but I can't do everything. I can't try to think I can do everything. We have to let people do it. And we have these great things. So we have AA is a three-legged stool. We have recovery. We have unity and we have service. But all three of those legs stand on the floor. And this is what our coin says: look to thine own self be true. So I obviously can't transmit something I don't have. So I have to keep continually working on, am I being true to myself? Am I doing things realistically? Am I aligning myself with this massive power? Because I didn't understand how big AA is. And now Zoom meetings, which we shouldn't call them Zoom, we should just call them virtual meetings, are a terrific way to connect everywhere. So I can often sit on different calls for concept calls. I sat on a Tradition 2 call of last Thursday from a past delegate from the state of Washington, and it was phenomenal just to get a different perspective and a different view on the second tradition. And what that means, and how that translates to your groups and what you're doing. And when you look at back at all this, and this is so new to me, even in my current role, which is a temporary position. It's a temporary position. I will serve one more year, God willing, and then someone else will take over. So my responsibility up and down the triangle is to make sure that people are aware of it. I don't have to teach them how to do it. I just have to make it look attractive and understand that the joy you get out of it is great and how structures work. And it always, 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 in my experience, boils down to the groups. And you guys are an excellent example of that. An excellent example of that. You have the different roles and the responsibilities, you have the different service commitments. People wrote, you have the spirit of rotation in and out of it. You go to a meetings, and when I was the alternate delegate on panel 72, I tried to get to every group meeting that we have in Area 50. Area 50, for you guys who aren't from around here or aren't in this area, it is comprised of eight Western New York counties. And we have over 900 meetings listed on the meeting guide app. Now, those are meetings that may meet multiple times a week, but there's over 900 meetings that are available. Of those 900, according to the information, which wasn't really accurate because some of the groups were defunct, there were about 330 that were active groups that they were tracking and doing that stuff. So the goal was to try to visit each one, not to do anything, but just to see it, touch it, feel it. And I had 2 years to do it, so it wasn't really that impossible a task. But I found that a lot of the meetings didn't exist, but most of them did. And there were a lot of people that were still running the same meeting. And there is a seasonality to everything in life, in recovery, in work, in everything you do, there's seasonality to it. And sometimes we get busy and sometimes things go, and that's just the way it is, and we have to accept the fact that some things continue and go, and some things should end. And we don't want things to end, or we think that the responsibility is so great that it's up to us entirely to do it. And that's simply not the case. So as I got to that was a good exposure to it, and then to see, like, well, how does this structure work? So it really boils down to, and it's back to Jim pestering me, which it wasn't a pester, I was grateful for it. I never looked at our calendar. So when I was the alternate delegate, it was a really easy job because the delegate was doing a lot of the work and she was very good at exposing me to stuff, but I didn't have to learn it all, although I probably should have learned it better in retrospect, like everything in my life. So I never looked at the calendar when they passed it for 2024. And when we just had our area assembly and we looked at the 2025 and 2026 calendar, I actually looked at it and was able to plan that I wouldn't have conflicts for travel, conflicts for work, conflicts for personal events that I wanted to attend so that I could work around that because I have to keep my recovery first and foremost. And the person that understands that best is my wife. Now, she wants nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. After having several AA members come in and do some work on our house, various carpenters, plumbers, contractors, we will never use an AA member as a hired worker anymore. That's just the way she is. So, not that the experiences have been bad, they just haven't been great. I think the work is fine, but that's a perfectionist. So, but she's all for it. She affords me a lot of latitude. She said to me something that, aside from if I wanted to live my life that way, that has resounded with me. And I think it's a great test and a great kind of benchmark if you're working with a newcomer or you're working with anyone. And she asked me this question, and she said, "Steve, when was the last time the truth got you in trouble?" And I paused. And she said, "That's your problem." I'm like, "What?" She goes, "You think the truth will get you in trouble. And so you do everything to avoid getting in trouble. When the truth will never get you in trouble. It will hurt. It can hurt, but it will never get you in trouble." And I just didn't know that. It took a non-alcoholic person to explain that to me. I was so afraid of things that I couldn't see or that I would do that I had no ability to be present. I was either mired in my fears of the future or just, stuck in the past of things I hadn't done or when they're going to find out. And how many balls can you juggle for so long before you finally come out to it and just accept it? So this whole sense of surrender that the first 12 steps of AA gives us, and that we just keep going after our willingness, our acceptance, our admittance, all those things tie into surrender to this power and this whole thing going through it. And then as we get into that leg, that through that one legacy, and we get into the tradition side to it, is how do we provide unity throughout our entire structure? Because this thing is massive. And I used to care about the numbers. How many members of AA are there? How many there aren't? If we are doing our jobs and we are there and we are making it available and we are showing that this thing can work, then they will come. Just like the money will come for everything we need to do. And we have a responsibility to continue to do that. So it's been that side to it and the service side to it is great. It gets more and more fun every time watching somebody go through it, the changes that are made that people see, you all experience it, the connections that are made, the places we can go, the network. It's a gift that you can't imagine when you first come in. And so I remember sitting with my sponsor, Chuck, who, I value his counsel more than, as much as my father's, who's since passed. So I rely on that. But I think, like my father, when I was growing up, I thought there was one voice in my house. And that's probably to some extent true. What I didn't understand about him and what I was able to understand as he became ill and fragile at the end, that my mother would not put him in a nursing home. So my brother, Paul, who lives in Buffalo, would go there in the mornings, help him get out of bed. We had a nurse's aide that would help my mom during the day. And then I would go every evening. And we did this for probably 15 months till he passed. And we entailed everything, changing him, cleaning him, doing all that stuff in and out of bed. And this was a bright, bright guy who had slipped into some level of form of dementia or whatever it was. But the one voice that was in my house was not really one voice. What he wanted me to find, and what I want all of you to find, And I hope you do within Alcoholics Anonymous is find your voice and find your voice within our literature and find your interpretation of it and how that this power has affected you. Continue to carry that message because that's all he really ever wanted. He did not want agreement. He just wanted to have an informed opinion and discussion based on facts. So I've had some personal tragedy through this. I have a daughter who's had some, substance abuse, alcohol and drug issues, as well as some trauma related stuff, and had to take her into a couple rehabs and work patiently with her. And I have no power to help her. I can be an example. I can be there. I can understand boundaries. I can understand all these things. So I used to have all these different biases about rehabs and they don't work and it's a money grab. And no, I think that genuinely people are there to help people get better and they serve a purpose and we serve a purpose as well. And we know what our purpose is. And as long as we are committed to that and everyone continues to place their recovery first, I think God sorts it out. I really do. I really do. I believe that, AA is bulletproof. It can only die from within. So we have to continue to be unified in this whole structure and piece of that side to it. And we will go in Area 50 from the, my job's to carry the torch for a little while. And it's been all the predecessors before have made it easier and easier. And we'll continue to walk this path. So it's a great thing. I'm going to wrap it up. I have this prayer. I say it every day. I love it. I'm sure a lot of you have heard it. It's attributed to Mother Teresa, but it's really not hers. When I read a little bit more into it about her, it was written on the wall of a madras that she taught at in Calcutta, and she then added some pieces to it, and it just makes sense. And I like it because it's a little bit of the abridged version of the 12 steps and maybe something that was out there prior to it, but it goes like this. For a sacrifice to be real, it must hurt. We must empty ourselves. The fruit of silence is prayer. The fruit of prayer is faith. The fruit of faith is love. The fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. And isn't that all you really ever wanted? Was just a little peace. Pleasure is easy. We all get pleasure. The peace and serenity that we get from working with one another and watching people get better is a truly gift beyond our wildest dreams. So thank you all for doing what you do. I appreciate you. Be well. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.